My question is for Frank. What is, when you give that talk in the Netherlands, what is the reaction in general?
Well, thank you for your question. Well, like I said in my speech, I mean, I say the most un-PC things, and people haven't got angry at me. And only one person has called me a racist once after a very modest article in the newspaper, and that was it. So apparently my arguments are pretty good, and I haven't been a non-person yet. So, but if I would gather more publicity, they would know how to find me, I think. You know, they would denounce me and stuff. So, but up till now, it's been okay. And the responses are also of relief. Like, as, you know, first, many people feel that there's something wrong with the egalitarian anti-discrimination movement and ideology, but they cannot pin it down. And so the book, that's why I like the book, because, and why I decided to write it, because in 100 pages, you're forever inoculated against egalitarianism. And you have your ammunition in your discussions with people who call you a racist or a sexist or etc. So there is a response of relief, but the audiences have mostly been liberty-minded or center, right of center. They don't want to invite me. No, it's amazing. I mean, I say the most outrageous things, and that would be, you know, whenever I talk, people are very talkative about it. They really like to discuss these things, which you would expect from university to welcome. And but no, they talk about very unimportant things, I think, often.
I have a question concerning the relation between Switzerland-Liechtenstein, but let's say Switzerland and Austria, which is, as we heard, very, very thoroughly friendly. Nevertheless, there are, we talked about that, Schweizer Witze jokes about Swiss. Of course, there are many Austrian jokes about Austrians in Switzerland. Generally, I would say also that there is a very good and friendly relationship, but maybe one point quite important within these historical contexts you mentioned that after World War One, when there was this vote in Vorarlberg whether they would like to come to Switzerland, the vote was tremendously for this change, but nevertheless it did not take place, among others because of Switzerland, that feared that too many Catholics come into Switzerland and change that order that was in Switzerland. Could you comment on that aspect too?
Yeah, my comment is that my speech was just related to the position the Austrians have against their to their neighboring states, and this may be mistakenly heard. I know that there are some discriminating ideas from the Swiss side to Austrians. So I just meant the Austrian view of the Swiss and the Liechtenstein people.
I wanted to add a point of view from the Katzelmachers, the Italians. It's just a reflection about what you said. In Italy, we have a distinct difference between the regions where the Austrians ruled, Lombardia, Veneto, Friuli, and even Toscana, which have a tradition of good administration, even with the mess of the Italian states, whereas the rest of Italy is more like disorderly Mediterranean, as you would expect. And so, to reflect about this, the Austrian Empire left a very good impression, even on the countries which fought the Austrian Empire bitterly, like Italy, which was built in the fight against Austria. And so I would like to hear your comment on this.
Yeah, I have nothing to say contradict what you said. I just want to add this term Katzelmacher is a thing from from decades ago. So the modern Austrians do not even know the bird. So it's my generation and the older ones who have some ideas of the times when the Italians changed the side and they began the war on our side and they ended it on the other side two times. and therefore this pejorative word stems from, but nowadays this absolutely died out.
May I add about the word Katzelmacher, because it's sometimes misunderstood. It has nothing to do with cat, making cats, but it means making kettles. Because there were people, particularly from the region of Friuli, who went to Vienna and they sold the kettles of people who were specialized on that. And from this kettle maker, it came out Katzelmacher.
I think it's not just in Italy, it's almost everywhere. The difference is still visible, interestingly, in, of course, the architectural patterns of the city, but then seemingly this tradition of better administration. But I think mostly it was the border between Western Europe and Eastern Europe that followed it, so there are many other reasons for differences. And the administration seems to have been quite efficient because at the time it was kind of Mandarin system where they really tried to attract an elite to the public service. So it was, for example, Böhm Bawerk who instituted direct income taxation, and he did so with an amazingly small number of public employees. So they were really orderly and efficient. Unfortunately, that wasn't such a good precedence to do so. But also it explains a bit, as long as the Austrian economists were part of the establishment, they thought that the minimal state is possible because they saw the potential of having a small elite with a very high, how do you say that, the pathos and the ethos of the administrators. So they really, or many of them, thought it was a privilege to be a servant for the public. And I think that may explain some of the better administration. But I think the main reasons are more cultural and more Western European.
I grew up in South Africa, so naturally the whole topic of discrimination was always very present. And when I left more than 20 years ago, We often had discussions about this. So anyway, about 15 years ago, I then, in thinking about this topic, realized that, similar to what you said, discrimination is a fundamental requirement of life. If I choose food instead of poison, I'm discriminating. And every living action, every single living action is an act of discrimination. So if you forbid discrimination, you're actually forbidding life. The interesting thing is then I realized, wow, okay, so that means if I forbid the government from discriminating, you're effectively forbidding government from taking actions. So I then designed a constitution that forbids the government only, but not private individuals from discriminating. Therefore, you would be limiting government, but still leaving room for, to go into details isn't the right place here, but it's kind of funny that one can turn it around on its head.
All right, well, thank you for your compliments for the talk. Yes, I didn't go into government discrimination, and it's easy to say for libertarians, well, governments shouldn't discriminate, but the Dutch government does discriminate regarding national holidays that are Christian. So in a way, they do enact religious discrimination, which was fine anyway, because 99% of the population was. Another thing is what they do, of course, with combating crime is to discriminate. And when they try to prevent people from having car accidents, they target young men. So it is very difficult not to discriminate, even for a government. But to discriminate in the way that Jim Crow laws, where they would say to bus companies, no, the blacks and whites should be separate. That is very immoral, I think. And the funny thing is also that anti-discrimination laws are actually similar to discrimination laws, because in both situations, the government tells us whom to associate with. So it's the other side of the same coin namely coercion. Did I answer your question well or respond to it? Thank you. We can talk about it later on. And that applies to everyone.
So what's your view on Bavarian? Bavarian?
Bavaria.
Yes. Do you think Austrians would be more friendly to Bavarian versus the German? Because I'm asking this because whether religion comes into play, because I believe Bavaria is mostly Catholic and the rest of Germany might be Protestant, so yes.
Yes, as I have said, most Austrians are Bavarianized Slavs, so they are quite close, apart from Vorarlberg, which are Alemannic, so it's a different Germanic tribe, so that may be the reason why Vorarlberg felt more attachment to the Alemannic Switzerland and Liechtenstein. So, of course, there's a cultural closeness, which is obvious between Bavaria and large parts of Austria. But I mean, there's no talk nowadays of joining Bavaria, of creating a big Bavaria. I've never read or heard about anything. And I think it goes back to Napoleon, change difference between Bavaria and Austria. So it's not a topic of today. It's just a cultural closeness. But then you see the closeness differently in the Slovenians in the south, of the same music and way of dressing. So it's very close to the Alpine cultures, which are German-speaking. So it's more this Alpine and rather Catholic identity.
The difference between the northern Germans and the southern Germans, the Bavarians in special, dates also back to the German War I mentioned in my speech, when the Bavarians fought on the Austrian side and lost against the Prussians. That may be an explanation for the resentments of the Bavarians against the northern Germans.
So to Carl, it seems to me that if the PC Brigade and the anti-discrimination movement were consistent in their thinking, they would be very much in favor of the free market, because there is no more relentless enemy of irrational prejudice than the free market. A sexist employer who chooses to pay a man 40% more than a woman simply because he doesn't want to employ women or promote women would get a 40% smack on his bottom line, which would soon sort out his prejudices. Yet all of them, all of the PCB grade, are fanatically anti-market. Have we as libertarians failed to convey the message that in fact the most egalitarian, most anti-prejudice institution that you could have is a free market if it were allowed to operate? You mentioned you're from South Africa. Strangely enough, one of the most effective apartheid laws was not the color bar laws which discriminated on color. It was the law which demanded the rate for the job. So you had to pay the same amount to a white man as the black man. Who would you choose, a white man who speaks English or Afrikaans, or who comes from a city and is acculturated, or a black man who's just come from the village and has no industrial experience, if you had to pay the same amount? There's no awareness of the fact that the free market allows the disadvantaged to discount their disabilities and to osmose into the mainstream and undermine the very foundations of prejudice. I think if that is the message that we could get across, we'd get a better understanding, hopefully, of what it means to be a libertarian.
Yeah, quite true. Thank you for your question or your comment. I didn't go into this very much, but many people have commented on the book that they say, many of these laws that don't seem to have anything to do, like you mentioned, about equal pay, are most detrimental to conducive to discrimination, like the minimum wage law and equal pay. Because, you know, feminism has this great reputation for me that they shoot themselves in the foot, because if you want equal pay, of course, and for any reason, good or bad or right or wrong, a company owner would say, well, I don't want to employ women. then and you have to and then the state demands that you pay them equally, or sorry, I want the company wants to pay them less for any reason, doesn't matter in this case, but economics says that in that case he will favor the men instead of the woman. You make it more easy for sexist to be sexist. And I don't think we really failed in explaining this. Well, we could do a lot more, and the book tries to help with that. But as with the PC Brigade, these people want to be, they look at good intentions. They don't care about bad results. They want to feel good about themselves, I think is often the case. I mean, this is not always the case, but I think it's often the case. And in my discussions with them, I noticed that. And a friend of mine, he mentioned, they want to be world improvers. They want to have the status of world improvers, but they don't care about improving the world.
No, they care about preventing individual choice. They do care about results. They have a hidden agenda. Their agenda is to interfere with individual choice, individual freedom, which they disguise behind this good intentions fabrication. They are very much results oriented.
Yeah, but different results than the good results. They.
It's hypocrisy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's a charade. It's the whole thing about good intentions, a charade.
Well, that we have to call them out for their inconsistency of their arguments and their shameful, shameless hypocrisy and their virtue signaling. I'm glad these words have become more common now, because now we can use them more often against them.
What's your opinion in Austria, the feeling about the EU? Do they want to have an exit as well, or do they voluntarily be brave and stay in the EU, or what is your opinion on this?
I would exclude it from the background of Austrian history. And the background of Austrian history is a continuous changing from small to great to small to great and whatever. So it happened several times in our history. And I think that the Austrians fundamentally are very afraid. They felt themselves treated badly by history in the 20th century. It was very difficult for them to get out of the insinuation that they were all Nazis. There were only about, would say, a third of them were Nazis, which is, would say, enough. But then they got the status of the first victim of Nazi aggression at the conference in Moscow in 1943. And afterwards, they built up their new identity. This is one side of the thing. The second side of the thing is that there is a strong anti-Austrian mood in the Austrian left. You remember what Andreas told about the idea of the unification with Germany in the First Republic, and the high degree of unity between social democrats and national liberals or Nazis. No? So they all wanted to go to Germany. The only group were the Christian Social Party of Dollfuss, who tried to continue this legalistic, loyalistic tradition of the monarchy, the independence of Austria, the Austrian idea for Central Europe, which was revived also after 1945. And so you have fundamentally two groups. In the left, there is still a kind of hate against the Republic of Austria, the idea of Austria itself, which you can see in this incredible Europeanism. No? So we have to overcome this old traditional and Catholic and reactionary Austria in order to be modernized, and we cannot do it out of our own forces, but we need the help of the European Union. So there are very few people in the in Austria which would openly say that it would be much better for us to leave the European Union. I am among them, but.
Yeah, I think, Austria is schizophrenic, is a split country. We say Vienna is a kind of waterhead or overblown. It was the center of a huge monarchy, now reduced to a little bit more than 10% of it, but retained the size and the bureaucrats and so on. And then there's rural Austria, and that's really split. And you can see the electoral results. It's like it boils down to binary results, and that will continue. So we have a polarized country. And at the moment, it's more than 50% in favor of staying with the status quo, because, of course, everything else is quite risky. But that may change in the future, and that's quite open.
So I agree that nobody actually, not nobody, but just a small portion of the Austrians really would prefer a dramatic change. So the Austrians are conservative from the onset, and they do not like changes at all. And now we are part of the European Union. It was a clear vote. How long ago? 20 years ago, something like that. So it was a clear vote to enter the Union, and I think it would be difficult to find a majority today to leave again. You have also to take into consideration that the media, to 100%, is propagandizing the... Yeah, so you cannot really fight against these forces successfully.
Do you think the follow-up to that, now that the government realizes that it's not very effective, is quotas, particularly in the workplace? Is that what is causing those changes?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that. What changes you
were... The quotas in the workplace in some countries.
Oh, yes.
Johan mentioned South Africa. That's an example where quotas are being implemented. We see it in Germany in the police force now. They're trying to sort of,
I think so,
not so direct but indirect quotas in government employment, and I'm sure it's happening elsewhere too.
Yes, thank you for your question, Aaron. I do think indeed that they see that the previous policies to get parity in the workplace didn't work. Actually, of course, they will not admit that it had a counterproductive effect. So they'll now come with the quotas, and they implement. Interesting, I write about this in the book too. They tried it Norway, to have a 40% minimum, 40% of board of directors needed to be female, according to The Economist, 200 companies went off the stock market because it was only applied to publicly traded companies, and of course you have many other companies, they started having token positions. So you can't fool nature. And so it will have a detrimental effect too. I mean, it will also stigmatize women because of that. And because, you know, due to weak, you need affirmative action, etc. And another side effect is that it stigmatizes women in the fact that if you have a certain position on your own merits, people will, and Thomas Sowell has written on this, and Walter Williams, but if you have rightly gained that position on your own merits, people will look at you not being certain whether you are there because of affirmative action. And suppose we would, I think Thomas Sowell gave that wonderful example, I think, of suppose the one Qantas Airlines or something, or British Airways has a policy of affirmative action for pilots, for women or minorities. You know, people would be very scared, or more scared to fly with them, because they would know that the pilots would be selected because of their characteristics and not their merits. So, although I'm sure there are very many eligible minority members or women that could do the job, but of course this is a unintended consequence. And did I answer your question? Thank you.
I want to make a funny addition. In this country, freedom of discrimination fully exists. Yes.
That's one of the advantages here. certain things you can say here, which would you get you into deep trouble at other places. But there are other things that are problematic to say here.
Well, I can comment on that because the first book, Beyond Democracy, was translated in 20 languages. And I thought about this book, The Discrimination Myth, but I thought, well, this is typically a Western item, an issue. It doesn't, you know, in Thailand, they don't have this. So I don't think there will be a Thai edition or a Turkish edition.
The question for the whole panel, there were some comments just now, again, talking about the difference between urban voters and rural voters in Austria, but we see it everywhere. We see it in the United States, the big population centers versus so-called flyover country. We see it in the Brexit vote between London and non-London. You mentioned Vienna versus the rest of Austria. So we see it everywhere. And I'm curious if you think that there's a possibility of a split at some point, political split between big cities and rural areas, and how this could play out, what the dynamics, how that could look.
A split like this is impossible along territorial lines, and that's why it's not thought about today. But actually, I think it's the more natural solution, and that would have been the only solution to keep alive the cultural realm of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, because you couldn't have split it along geographic lines. But obviously, the settlement was very different in cities and in the countryside, and for example, in what is today Ukraine and was then Galicia, Lemberg was a Polish city with German Jews, and the countryside was all Ruthenians, which are now called Ukrainians. So it's impossible to just carve out a nation state, but it would have made sense to have cities as autonomous and diverse concentration points, like a harbor or so on, or not. In the trade routes, whereas you have the countryside, which is organized along different lines and more homogeneous lines. So I think that's the solution that out of history would make most sense, but it's so far from our current political thought that I don't see it as any feasible solution to the problems. Because, I mean, carving out Vienna out of Austria today along territorial lines wouldn't make any sense. You wouldn't want to have a wall and no exchange. I mean, Vienna would die immediately without having access to the trade routes and the countryside. So this idea of having autonomy but being open, that's very hard to grasp at the moment. And that's why a lot of reaction towards the European Union and decentralization tends to shut down, and that I don't really like about these reactions, and a lot of course, the countryside reaction against the more urban cosmopolite elites is a bit reactionary in a negative sense, in that they think they just shut down and have their autonomous or even autarky regions, and that of course doesn't make sense. So it's a different way of thinking about politics, which I hope will remain as the only peaceful solution to cope with the polarization we're seeing at the moment.
I think there are several dimensions of this question. From the historical point of view, it was a very highly discussed topic of the conferences in Saint-Germain in Versailles after the First World War. So the question fundamentally was, when the town is dominated by a certain nationality, should we take the town and then attach the surrounding regions and villages, or should the town be incorporated in the majority of the people outside? That was a very important question, for instance, in a town like Fiume, nowadays Rijeka, which was mostly Italian, with Hungarians living there and Germans also, circundated by a Croat population, or the same thing with Slovenes in Trieste. And they decided, in the case of Yume, to give it to the Slavs. Then there was a rebellion. You probably heard of Gabriele D'Annunzio, who was a poet, an Italian, and he organized an military expedition, and he occupied the town for a certain period. And then it was given to, after the war, after 45, to Yugoslavia, to the Slavs. Now, this is one side. I think this is decided because you cannot change these assets anymore, as it has been done after two wars. The second thing, but is I think what you meant before, is the growing difference between the from the cultural point of view and the political point of view of urban and popular, let's say, of an urban and the popular part of the strata of the population. And this you see in nearly all elections. No? Particularly interesting was the outcome of the regional elections in Germany now in Saxony and in Brandenburg, where you had a tremendous victory of the so-called populist Alternative für Deutschland and enormous losses for the political parties. And the outcome is, or was, that the voters voted much more to the right than ever, and they will get governments much more on the left than ever, because they are all getting together and form an anti-AfD coalition, which continues to make the things even worse. The question is how long this can continue, no? Because the people want to have answers on questions like mass migration, centralization, the loss of incentives, whatever. I mean, how long can it last? And how long can it last that you ignore the democratic will of the people?
I have two questions for the Austrians. You can pick which one you want to answer. One of them was the map of the Hungarian Empire, Austrian-Hungarian Empire. What was interesting, all these pockets of different languages, especially Hungarians in Romania, and especially Germans all over. What has happened to them? I mean, I traveled to Romania a couple of years ago, and there is definitely still a lot of that culture and all that there. Is there a movement, or what's happening to those minorities? And the other one is the political mess you've had and the entertainment with your political developments in Austria lately. Is there any hopeful signs in that?
So I respond to your second part of the question. Here's the expert for the first part. So actually, I do not see any good solution which can occur in the next future. We have elections in 2 weeks, as you know. And there is a good chance that the former chancellor will be the next chancellor. So this young man called Sebastian Kurz. But he threw the so-called right-wing Freiheitliche Partei out of the government, and I do not see a realistic chance to get that again, despite the fact that the majority of the Austrians, or a relative majority of the Austrians, prefer this kind of a coalition between the Freiheitliche and the ÖVP. I think that the feelings of the really strong forces in the ÖVP are great coalitioners. So they really want to have again a coalition with the Social Democrats, which they had for 30 years. And this was not good for the country, in my opinion. But I do not really see a realistic chance to have a second Auflage, second stage of a coalition between the Freiheitlichen and the ÖVP. So in the short run, I do not see any light on the end of the tunnel.
Regarding the national minorities in the East, well, there were different tactics after the First World War. The main problem was that with the dissolution of the, it's okay now? Okay. Well, thank you. after the dissolution of the dual monarchy, didn't change the pattern, the demographic pattern of the territories there. So there were still Germans living there. There were still Romanians in Hungary and whatever, Hungarians in Romania. There were some changes after the First War. That means people working for the Austrian-Hungarian monarchy from the centralized government had to leave Slovenia, for instance, partly also the Czech Republic. But most of all, the structures, the minorities map remained as it was under the dual monarchy. That changed after the Second World War, because after the Second World War and after the atrocities committed by the Germans and by the Nazis there, there was this the ethnic cleansing with brought about 12 to 13 million people from Germans from the eastern part of Europe to Germany and to Austria. But there were still, and Romania is a good example, there were still minorities who could remain in Romania, because Romania was never as anti-German as, for instance, the Czech Republic or Poland. No? So they were rather accepted there. And they remained. And then they became an object of business under Ceausescu. So Ceausescu, the communist dictator of Romania, literally sold the German minority to Germany. The Germans had to pay, I think, something about much money, but not, I think, about 50,000 marks for a person. Yeah, and they went to Germany, and then he sold the Jews to Israel. No? So the last kind of ethnic cleansing was done in a capitalist way, in the sense that you treat people like the property of a dictator. Yeah.